accession number 18463, reel 24.
On reel 24.
Yes, so there was this chap on the right of my second position, Chinese, wrapped round a tree, and he'd been hit in the stomach, I guess, with phosphorus or something unpleasant, and he was burning away there rather badly. And every time I got near him to move him, a grenade would go off or a shot would go off, and I tried throwing some soil over him to put the fire out, and I thought about trying to pull him off round the tree, but he was wrapped so tightly around it I couldn't move him. And so I left him. And company commander came up and said, why has this body not been removed and buried? Because, you know, hitting British all was like a nice, tidy battlefield. And I said to him, well, every time I get near him, he explodes. He said, well, leave him and he'll go off the boil shortly and you can deal with it then. As it happened, he never did. And I can't remember how many days we were there, but from the 14th to, I guess, about the 17th or 18th, he was still burning, and not terribly pleasant actually, because there was a terrible smell and what have you. Anyway, at that moment we looked down in the valley, and a company was coming up. It turned out to be C Company actually, who were going up to clear a hill up on the east right on our right flank, as it were, and they were advancing in open order. Came up to the two Chinese that were laying ahead of down below us, the two special ones that had been shot by A Company, who were escorting the prisoners back, and turned them over, went on. And I'd forgotten to say, in actual fact, a lot of the Chinese had, the wounded, had crawled over to some high trees, which were literally in front of us, in front of my section, that is, and slightly to the right. And they were sitting round them, in circles round these trees. It looked most peculiar. We couldn't make it out at first, but until we realised they must be wounded. And this is literally what they'd done. I guess it's, you know, comradeship and all the rest of it. And they were sitting in circles around these trees. Unfortunately, they all died sitting in circles around these trees, but that was not until the following night. And anyway, C Company went off down the valley and sent a patrol over to a village. There was a village just ahead of us with tiled roofs. Must have been a very old village, I should think. Usually they're straw, but generally speaking, they was tiled roofs. And we heard later the patrol found that absolutely full of wounded and people, you know, crawled away to die in there. And they went on, got within about, I guess about, I know it's difficult to judge, 200 or 300 yards of this little hill that they were supposed to clear, which was part of a great complex of hills, in actual fact. It was just a little ridge off of it, and got open fire on. It was quite good to watch them, actually, because they did it rather well. They started to do a right flanking, and we could see the platoon doing the right flanking on the right-hand side, but they were being held down by... the main body was being held down by heavy machine guns and light machine guns. We could see the tracer coming down towards them. It's sort of like watching a film, really. And we could see them scurrying through the trees, and they're doing quite well. But a decision must have been made to stop the attack, because they held, and we saw the carriers then, the MNG carriers, go shooting by, all bouncing over the frozen ground and over the paddy and what have you. Funny enough, we saw one of the blokes who we knew, Higgs, and they were all saying, there's blooming Higgs again going out there. He was a number one on a MMG. He had plenty to say for himself. And they went up just forward of where, and to the flank of where the company were, and opened fire. And that was a wonderful sight, really. There was old Higgs there with all this stuff being fired back at him, standing up behind his machine gun in the back of the carrier there, firing away, and they're saying, look at Higgs again. that was quite good. But anyway, they covered C Company back. I don't know if they had any casualties. I've got a feeling they didn't have any casualties. But they may have had some wounded, but I don't know if they certainly didn't have anybody killed. And they came back, and the decision was made because the sensible way to clear this ridge was to go along the high ridge and obviously see it from above. And the Argyles were working their way down the right-hand flank, and the Australians were working their way on the left-hand flank. And again, there was a long bit of a pause here, and the CO came up now, and or rather, he was the CO, but he was the acting brigadier at this moment, Colonel Mann, and he came walking down with his intelligence officer and his crew of people, walking down there briskly, his normal way, and got to the forward ridge. And of course, the Chinese must have spotted him and fired a few mortar bombs over, which sent us scurrying down into our slit trenches. And I didn't see him anymore then, so I guess that he'd attracted a bit of fire. But these mortar bombs are most peculiar, really. I mean, they were more like rockets than mortar bombs. I mean, you know, mortar bombs have the firing explosive in bags around the tails, but these were just like rockets. In fact, we couldn't believe that they were anything but rockets at first until they exploded. I think they wounded another one of the A Company wounded in the little gully where they were being treated. Anyway, the brigadier presumably went off back to battalion, having drawn this little bit of fire on us, and we settled down for a reasonably quiet session. We're looking out on the very high ridge on our left-hand side, which was literally a slope of virgin snow, and we saw a chap clambering up it. We couldn't make out what he was. We wondered if he was an Aussie. That's the only thought we could have. He must have been an Australian. But to cut the story short, we think afterwards he was probably a Chinese escaping, but nobody fired at him, and we couldn't tell what he was, Australian. And he vanished over the ridge. Where he vanished, we learned later the Australians weren't up that far, so we can only guess he was a Chinese getting away. And there was apparently I didn't see this, but there was a Jeep on the road over there with some Americans who'd been shot up, but I didn't see that particular Jeep. And I never saw it in actual fact. And one of A Company had been, unfortunately, got opposite one of the other platoons in a most peculiar position, had been hit, been wounded, and he must have thought the hill was occupied by the Chinese, because he was calling out, me English, and every time he called out they shot him, and he had a number of extra wounds, but eventually he was brought in, and okay, I guess. But they'd had quite a number of casualties. The day was reasonably quiet then, and I don't know where he'd been, but one of the corporals had been saying for some time that he was going to shoot himself in the foot. He'd got past it, and he'd have to go, and we'd all, I'll be honest, we've made quite a bit of fun about it. This had been going on since Christmas. And he came up, had his head down. He'd obviously come in from battalion quarters, I suppose, and I called down to him, because we were geeing him up all the time, and said, "How about it then?" Whatever his name was. And he called back and he said, "Tonight's the night." And I said, "Oh yeah, heard that before." Anyway, stand to, nothing happens during stand to. At stand down, just as it's called, there's a shot. And of course he has done the business. He's done it quite well too, really. He's had a Sten, and he's jabbed his bayonet in his leg and pulled the trigger and shot himself in the foot. He had him on the back of the trench there. The MO was brought up because we were such a tight perimeter that he could come up. MO came up and he's treating him, got him there. I heard later, funny enough, that a friend of his also did the same thing that night. So there were two of them, must have perhaps had a little pact. Anyway, he's laid there. And as he's laying there, he suddenly said, "I'll never make sergeant now." And it was too much for me, I laughed. And the MO said, "Quiet that man, this is a serious situation," and I crept away. But I really always thought that was quite an amusing thing from somebody who deliberately just shot themselves to say, "I'll never make sergeant now." And the rather amusing thing was, when I eventually saw him again in Hong Kong at the end of the war, I said, "How'd you get on then, SIW, because it's not a very popular way to be wounded." And he said, "Oh, I tore the label off on the way down, that they put it on, a self-inflicted wound." He tore it off. He said, "When I got down, they said, 'Where's the label? Where's the label?' I said, 'Oh, how were you shot? I've shot with a sniper. He said, so he got away with it like that. It didn't do him any harm, in actual fact. But people reach the limit of their endurance. And it's a brave man who could shoot himself in the foot. It's not a terribly pleasant thing to do. I never felt any feelings against him or any of the others that faded away out of it. Not at all. Not then or afterwards. Some people do. I've met people since who are very upset about certain situations, but who cares? I don't know. Anyway, that night went off quietly. And the following, that night, we got thick fog came down over the area. Very cold, very thick, freezing fog. And when it lifted in the morning, one of the Chinese that was laying in front of us, well, I guess 200 yards in front of us, I suppose, as we were up on the hill, he vanished. So whether or not he wasn't dead when C Company turned him over, or whether or not they'd come, their old trick of coming out and taking the dead, they'd like to remove all their dead. And of course, it's supposed to frighten you to death if they come out and sneak out and take one of their dead away. And I pointed it out to air chaps. He's gone. And none of them could even remember seeing him. So, you know, it hadn't worked very well if it was supposed to frighten us a bit. But unfortunately, during the night, all the Chinese dead that were around the trees about 200 or 300 yards out, it was obvious that they died during the night. The cold had just done for them. And my little friend that I'd gone down to try to help, he was dead as well. But there'd been also another four platoon had rather a lot of unpleasant, gruesome bodies to bury. And one of their lance corporals, during the night, this is the night that's gone, he'd broken down and he had to be stretched away. He was I don't know what he was doing it for, but he was an ex-bandsman, actually, drummer, bugler fella. And in fact, I've seen him in many photographs since, but he had to be carted away because he'd broken down. And I went down in the valley and I found a sleeping bag thrown down there with, obviously, somebody had been caught in a sleeping bag and shot. There were about four shots in it and quite a bit of blood around. And there had been some rumours that some of them had been caught in there, asleep in their sleeping bags and killed there. But, I mean, they were only rumours. I don't know if they're true. But all I can say is I did see a blood-stained sleeping bag, which had obviously been thrown away to hide it from anybody looking at it. During the course of that day, I saw Chris Lawrence, the second lieutenant Chris Lawrence, who was 4 platoon commander, going down towards Battalion HQ. And when he came back, I heard in the meantime that he was going down to be told that he'd been awarded the Military Cross for his actions on the Nakdon and the capture of Plum Pudding Hill. Well deserved, very, very well deserved. And when he came back, I said to him, I called out and said, "Where's the ribbon then?" And what? He was a bit embarrassed by it all, so I shut up and let him go. But that was a well-deserved Military Cross that he got there. And we stayed there a few days, pretty cold. And the Argyles came up on our right and got ahead of us. The Australians got up on their left. Had to fight. The Australians had to fight all the way. The Argyles didn't. And I as I remember, the Six Rock were over again on the right flank. And they were slowly moving up. And we got so that where we'd been a V, where we were the tip of the V forward, we were now the base of the V back. We were literally the reserve battalion. Very stiff fighting on the Australian side. And of course the rumours abound, don't they? And it was rumoured that they were desperate to get forward because they'd seen some jeeps that they wanted to scrounge. American abandoned jeeps. Anyway, the Chinese began to literally melt away, in actual fact. They've just began to melt away. It was really common that sort of happened, I suppose it happened on both sides. And they were withdrawing. And the word came that we were going to go forward and into Chorny itself and clear Chorny. We went down, we were called down onto the road. We had to abandon quite a bit of stuff, actually. We took our captured weapons down, and the colour sergeant wanted two, please, and said, "Well, all right, I'll put him on the wagon," but I suspect he just left him on the side of the road. I kept my M1, ever so heavy and cumbersome, and we started to march up the main road. The road was clear by now. And we came to a spot where a couple of days before we'd seen a Chinese going through the motions of laying mines, digging little holes, or supposedly digging little holes, putting something in it. And because there were, by this time, there were a couple of tanks back there I guess they were concerned they might make a breakthrough. And as we came to this spot, we were a bit careful, because the guns had fired him. He was out the range of our LMGs, but the 16 field had put a couple of shots over, and he'd sort of vanished in a cloud of smoke. But I don't think they hit him. I think he got away. I don't think he had any mines. I think it was just a ruse. And they were very accurate, 16 field. And they were saying, the FFO had told me, that they were restricted with ammunition and they were only allowed one shot for ranging. And they reckoned that they could fire out of three shots, they were expected to get the third onto a slit trench. I think that's probably a bit of an exaggeration, but they were pretty close. They were very, very good. Anyway, we marched through into the village and we saw some Americans. They were prisoners. Apparently the Chinese had abandoned them. And they'd kept them in this hut, which, of course, we'd been shelling that village, or our guns had been shelling that village, so they were very lucky. But they were looking pretty pretty downcast. And we went on then through the village, and we passed through a scene where the two American companies apparently had been withdrawing when the Chinese attacked them. And they just caught them in the open. I don't know how many dead there were there. Later reports said 80 or 90. And I wouldn't doubt that at all. Mainly black lads they were. Their boots have been taken off. And they've been robbed of their socks. You'll see, incidentally, if you read histories and stories about this, they've been robbed of their boots. Quite wrong. Boots are too big for any Chinese foot. It was the socks they were after. And the boots were actually by the side of them. Somebody called out and said, don't touch them, they're probably booby traps. So we left them, but I guess people coming along behind whipped the boots, and then everybody thought they'd stolen the boots. There were a devil of a lot of them there. One of the most peculiar things was that a lot of the black lads had a bootlace tied around one ankle. I can't remember which, left or right, one or the other. I guess it was some sort of token that keep them safe. Unfortunately it didn't. My M1's weighing me down now, so I chuck that out to them as well. All the arms are gone. And there were two jeeps, might have been three jeeps, in line, facing towards us, empty of everything, on the side of the road. And I guess this had probably been done by the Chinese. I don't think it's true, but standing behind one of the jeeps was a young American officer, blonde hair. He was as if his climbing into the back of this jeep. His hands were on the back of the jeep. His one leg was up, and he was dressed only in long johns, and it was frozen solid, and there was a blood red patch in the middle of his back. And I can only imagine that he had been stood up there by the Chinese. I imagine. I don't know that. I imagine that's what happened, but it did unfortunately bring a story later from the Canadians, which they've written up, that the Americans have been caught in their pyjamas and shot down trying to climb into their jeeps. But nothing of the sort. They weren't in pyjamas at all. Although, unfortunately, of course, we did find a lot of them in the houses where they've been killed. The houses have then been built, are burnt around them, and there were a lot of dead bodies in the houses. We went forward to the crossroads. My section was told to go over and clear the right flank there, and we went over and we found a little gully there, a little depression in the ground, and it was obvious that a 50 caliber machine gun had been parked there at some time, so that meant it was an American post, which I guess they put out, and of course the usual big fire had been there, and they'd obviously had this going. And I guess they must have been surprised by the Chinese and taken prisoner without firing a shot, because there were a lot of footprints all round the edge, and they just cut them and the gun off. I mean, the fire would have attracted anybody in, And one supposes once that had gone, they went into the village and slaughtered the guys who were, we believed, asleep in the village without too many sentries out. I can't go along with the pyjama bit. I think it's this poor lad in his comms, but there we are. Anyway, we went up, climbed up above the village, 6 platoon, and we dug in on the top of this crest there. Nothing happened. Chip Yong Ni, the place that we were supposedly trying to get through, had been relieved by an armoured column with terrible casualties, I might add, not to the tanks, but to the people who arrived on the outside. And that is another story. And we stayed there overnight. This would have been the 19th, I think. 18th, that's right. And the following morning, John Swarbrick called me over and said that he'd been relieved. He was going off. I can't remember if he was going off to be 2IC of the company or MTO, one or the other. He was going off, and he left me in command of the platoon and said there'd be a new platoon commander along sometime during the morning. Anyway, you do the normal things that you do, looking after the platoon. Because we had no platoon sergeant. We hadn't had a platoon sergeant since Gus was killed at Chongju. Yes, Chongju. And I was squatting there. It was rather funny, really, because all the Korean men, older men, they squat on their heels. And they could squat there for hours, it seemed. They never seemed to meet their head. And I'd adopted this, and quite a number of us had adopted this. We couldn't do it for more than, say, half an hour or something like that. But it keeps your bottom off the cold ground, and presumably in the summer, the wet ground. And it's quite a way you can squat down. I was squatting down there at the top of the path where I knew the platoon commander had come up. And I saw him start to climb up the hill. As he got a few yards up the hill, I thought, gosh, I know who that is. That's Rex Kane. We've been in training together. And sure enough, it was Rex Kane. He was a graduate. So when he passed out, he automatically became a lieutenant. So unfortunately, although completely inexperienced, he's senior to the people like Chris Lawrence. But that's the way the army operates. Anyway, he came up, and I could see he was having difficulty getting up the hill because he was never very good at climbing. Not very good at all. And we got to the, he came up there and he looked, put his head up and looked at me, and I could see he wanted to say, hello, Don, but he obviously, we both stopped ourselves, and he said, oh, good morning, Corporal. How funny seeing you here. And that's a similar thing. Introduced him to the section commanders, the other two section commanders, three section commanders. And no platoon sergeant, because I'm acting platoon sergeant. You don't have very hardly any duties to do, but you act when you haven't got one. And he told me that we'd got a platoon sergeant. I didn't know the chap, the new chap. He was apparently had been colour sergeant of C Company. He was Middlesex and had been with a battalion, but he appointed colour sergeant of C Company, and he'd been busted for some reason or other. So we didn't see him that day. But the following day, we went down to the bottom of the hill, and it was all quiet, nothing going on. The Canadians are going through, and there was a thaw had set in, and there's slush everywhere. And we went down to the bottom of the hill, and somebody had decided, I guess it must have been the Major Gwynne as acting CO, that we should wear plimsolls with a rubber overboot with metal fastenings up the front. They came up to just about gaiter height, so we handed in our boots and our gaiters, put them in our bedding rolls, and put on these plimsolls and these rubber boots. They were dreadful things. I mean, you couldn't run in them, you couldn't dig in them because they, you know, your instep and things like that. But they certainly kept your feet dry for a bit, but marching them were absolutely terrible. And we went on then. We had to clear a valley, and we spread out across this valley, and 6 platoon was on the far side of the valley, and then there was about a 200 yard gap, 4 platoon and presumably 5, I guess, what must have been a company HQ on the road. We could just about see them advanced up this valley, and first sight was a house where the roof had been probably burnt in or fallen in or something. The poor old chap in there, and he was on his back, laid on his back with his arms up in the air, as if he'd been trying to stop the roof falling on him. Went on a bit. And eventually, as it got dark, we were told to stop. We've been going virtually all day since early morning, so I don't know, no idea how far we've gone. And it gets dark about 4 o'clock by this time, and we were told to stop anywhere where it was reasonably convenient. And we found a lone house, and we couldn't dig in. We got no tools, no bedding, no main bedroom. We got a bedding roll on our back, but no main bedding. And the policy would always be that Platoon HQ would go into the house, the sections would dig it if they could, around about it, and then you'd use the house, you know, for brewing up, and if you could light a fire in there, because you couldn't light one outside, and you'd allow people in, you know, to get a little bit of warmth and rest. Anyway, it got dark. We couldn't dig in. We found a wallow. That's all I can describe. I think pigs or something had lived in it with all sticks all around it. And we decided that we'd better get our section in there. So we got everybody in there. And Bill was on the right flank. And all he could do was lay his section down in the plough furrows. And there wasn't anything else. In pile bits of frozen ground up. Because it's frozen solid again, incidentally, from the thaw. It's frozen again. It's made it even worse. It's really bad now, and or as bad as it had ever been in January. And one of the lads came over and said, "Hey, we're not allowed to go in. The house is out of bounds. We can't go in and brew up or heat a kinny." I thought, "It can't be." And Wardy came over to me then and said the same thing, and he said to me, "Well, you better go and see him. He's your mate. You better go and sort it out." I said, "Well, you're right. I better." So I go over and I saw the new platoon sergeant. I'd never seen him before. I had any conversation with him at all. And I said to him, "I've just been told the platoon HQ's the house is out of bounds to everybody." He said, "Yeah, that's right." I said, "You're joking, aren't you?" He said, "No, I'm not. It's out of bounds." I said, "Well, you're an active service. You don't have things out of bounds." I'll be honest, I said a bit more than that. I'll be honest, I lost my temper completely with him. Absolutely and utterly. And I cursed him and swore him and said a lot of rude words to him. And walked away, telling him what to do with himself. But Rex must have heard it, but I think he chose not to hear it. And I thought to myself, "Well, that's me. I'm finished tomorrow morning. I'll be up in front of the company commander, charged insubordination." It seemed very reasonable, because I mean the company commander would have to take the word of a sergeant who'd been sworn and told to what to do with himself. Anyway, we spent the night absolutely frozen stiff in our little positions. We couldn't heat anything up. We had to have cold rations, cold drink, and the water bottles were freezing. The following morning, we moved on. We moved over back to the road now. In fact, we moved forward until we formed a position around, having been the forward company, we're now the rear company, and we were reserved round Battalion HQ. And I thought to myself, "Well, I'll be up now." Never heard a word about it. He never said a word. He just went on as if it never happened with me and with everybody else. Totally ignored it. Anyway, that day we didn't dig in. Funny enough, I really don't know why that was, and we didn't actually go up on the hills, which would have been the normal practice. So I presume it was they thought this area was clear. Rex came over and said that he was taking a patrol, an officer patrol. You have officer patrols and NCO patrols. Officer patrol is if they really want some valuable information.